As the sun descends behind the redwoods, elaborately robed men gather at the base of a 40-foot stone owl. They place a human-shaped wicker effigy on an altar. They try to ignite it, but have trouble. A voice booms from the owl, instructing them to use the Lamp of Fellowship. They do as commanded, and the wicker figure is soon ablaze. Chanting and music fill the air as hundreds of other robed figures look on. In this way, some 2,000 members of a secret society known as the Bohemian Club kick off their annual 3-week summer retreat at a private woodland playground. The ritual is called the Cremation of Care. It doesn't take much imagination to see the ceremony as a mock human sacrifice. Some critics allege it's a thinly disguised pagan cult masquerading as an exclusive men's club. Conspiracy theorists, such as Alex Jones, even claim it's a vestige of an ancient Canaanite, Luciferian, Babylonian mystery religion known as the Cult of Moloch, a deity to which children were burned as sacrifices. Others see a sinister manifestation of druid rites or a secret owl society linked to the 18th century Bavarian Illuminati. Still others detect the odor of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. A Bohemian Club brother would insist that the ceremony, like the club itself, is just for fun. Nobody's gathering in the woods to worship Moloch. They just want to kick back and enjoy some hijinks. Of course, the main reason Bohemian Grove attracts attention is because those who gather there aren't ordinary men. They're all rich. Writer F. Scott Fitzgerald once said that the rich are different from you and me. For many who attain great wealth, there's a nagging question. Why me? Am I rich because of talent, luck, or providence? Am I chosen? If so, for what? The answer that creeps into the heads of some is that they have wealth to achieve some great thing. If so, then what better way to realize this than by joining with others similarly chosen? Bohemian Club members are men, men only, of wealth and influence. CEOs, politicians, financiers, media figures, and a smattering of entertainers. Their ranks have included some real global movers and shakers like Henry Kissinger and Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Bush 1 and 2. Many others make decisions that shape corporate, governmental, and even international policies. So, critics argue, we have reason to be curious about what they're doing out in the woods. In this lecture, the Bohemian Club is just one example of the elite secret societies we'll be looking at. Since almost all secret societies promise their members special status, what do we mean by elite? I'll define an elite secret society as one that exclusively recruits members who are already or likely to be rich or influential. As always, the society offers the fellowship of people like themselves. It might also offer them the ability to become even richer and more influential. Are they just rich guys having rich guy fun? Or are they our secret masters working their magic? The Bohemian Club was born in 1872 in the offices of the San Francisco Chronicle. Initially, it was a club for newspapermen. That's where Bohemian comes from. Bohemian was then a term for a wandering reporter, a trade most of the founders had practiced. Artsy types like painters and writers were only admitted as honorary members. That distinction soon disappeared. The club's growing reputation and exclusiveness attracted businessmen. The advantage of rich members was that they could pay for things like a tract of old-growth forest north of the city, the future Bohemian Grove. Journalists and artists never entirely disappeared from the club's roster, but by the turn of the 20th century, they were outnumbered by CEOs and politicians. The club's motto is a quote from A Midsummer Night's Dream, "Weaving spiders come not here." It means that no one was supposed to bring work into the club. But that didn't mean they wouldn't talk about it. So where does the owl come from? It was the club's emblem from the start. While there was indeed an ancient Near Eastern god called Moloch, and children were sacrificed to it, there's no connection between Moloch and owls. The owl was most obviously associated with the Greco-Roman goddess of wisdom, Athena or Minerva. The founder of the 18th century Bavarian Illuminati, Adam Weishaupt, also picked the great owl of Minerva as the symbol of his secret order. And the Illuminati owl and the Bohemian owl look very similar. But then, all owls pretty much look alike, don't they? Still, the Bohemians likely lifted their emblem not from the Illuminati, but from another secret society known as Schlaraffia. Bet you've never heard of that one. Schlaraffia was a German order that started, guess where? In Bohemia in about 1859. Specifically in the Bohemian capital of Prague. German immigrants brought it to the United States and to San Francisco. The group's totem was the Owl of Bohemia. Schlaraffia attracted artists, actors, and musicians. Its rituals were designed to parody the rites of more serious secret societies such as the Freemasons. In other words, Schlaraffia, like the Bohemian Club, was ostensibly about having a good time. So the best bet is that the Bohemians started as an Americanized ripoff of Schlaraffia. But there might have been something more at work. There usually is. Prague was also the home to an occult secret order called the Sat Bai, or Asiatic Brethren. Sat Bai rituals incorporated the Jewish Kabbalah, alchemy, and ritual magic. Everything they did was shrouded in allegory and secrecy. And there was heavy crossover in membership between Sat Bai and Schlaraffia. That's the thing about secret societies. People often belong to more than one. Lines and doctrines start to blur. So if the Bohemian Club drew its inspiration from Schlaraffia, it might have absorbed some occult elements as well. But it was no cult of Moloch. In any case, Bohemian Club rituals evolved over time. There was no owl statue until the 1920s, and the cremation of care rite didn't come together until later, along with a shift towards greater exclusiveness and greater secrecy. Membership and rituals were more closely guarded after 1930. Some link this to the influence of one member, Herbert Hoover, businessman and president. Hoover hailed the Grove as the greatest men's party on earth. Today, most remember Herbert Hoover as the president who ushered in the Great Depression. But Hoover had a long career steeped in international business and secret diplomacy. According to one ex-Bohemian, Hoover and his bunch brought in people from the East Coast and D.C., and older members dropped out. The whole thing became a lot more political. But the club was never just or mostly politicians. Members also included the likes of publisher Henry Luce and financier David Rockefeller. Walt Disney stayed there as a guest in 1936, and that visit heavily influenced the look of his animated film Snow White in 1937, especially the snoring scene. Another guest was Richard Nixon. He was invited to give a Grove Lakeside talk in 1967. The experience, Nixon wrote, was the first milestone on my road to the presidency. He was being evaluated, and he knew it. That's the kind of influence some find suspect and even dangerous. However, Nixon offered another view of the Grove festivities in a recorded phone conversation. He called them, and I quote, the most faggy goddamn thing you could imagine. Nixon is partly echoed by writer John Ronson, who got a peek inside the Grove in the early 2000s. Ronson came away with a pervading sense of immaturity and pseudo-pagan spooky ritual. The Grove's alcohol-fueled hijinks, amateur theatrics, and cabins with names like Caveman, Moonshiners, and Mandalay all smack of a summer camp for rich boys. The Bohemian Club's influence, like its paganism, is probably exaggerated. But that doesn't mean it has none. Secret societies bring like-minded people together in an atmosphere of trust. Intended or not, that can become a petri dish for all kinds of intrigue, like insider trading and revolutions. It becomes even more volatile when money and power are added to the mix. Weaving spiders will weave, no matter what. It's not unusual for Bohemian Brothers to belong to other secret societies, nor unusual for these societies to intersect with the Bohemian Club. An excellent example is the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. In 2016, Scalia died suddenly, some thought mysteriously, at the remote and exclusive Cibolo Creek Ranch in West Texas. Scalia and some 30 others were guests of the ranch's owner, investment banker and industrialist John B. Poindexter. Many of them were members of the International Order of St. Hubertus, a knightly society of hunters and conservationists. St. Hubertus had the usual trappings of Grand Master, internal degrees, oaths, and initiations, plus ritual dark green robes emblazoned with a cross. St. Hubertus was founded in 1685 in, where else, Bohemia. Its American branch was inaugurated in 1966 at San Francisco's Bohemian Club. It brings up a familiar question. In St. Hubertus and the Bohemians, are we looking at two different societies, or just one in slightly different forms? There's also a crossover between the Bohemian Club and the European-based Bilderberg Group. One example is David Rockefeller, the late Wall Street banker, who was also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the founder of the Trilateral Commission. Rockefeller purportedly believed in the supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers, according to a leaked French transcript of his remarks. The Bilderbergers first appeared in 1954. Their name comes from the site of their initial meeting at the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek, Netherlands. The real name of the group, if it has one, is a secret. The meetings have continued every spring. So what do the Bilderbergers do? About all they'll say is that they're an informal advisory body to the Atlantic Alliance. Some say Bilderberg is a manifestation of synarchy, a shadowy movement that aims to govern the world through a technocratic elite. Researcher Daniel Estulin speculates they're an extrapolation of an older elite society, the Coefficients Club. We'll come back to that. Maybe the most interesting thing about the Bilderberg Group are its two founders, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands and Joseph Rettinger. Both were men of vague nationality and questionable ethics. The prince was a German aristocrat who at one point became a Nazi Party and SS member. In 1937, Bernhard married Princess Juliana of the Netherlands and more or less transformed into a Dutchman. Prince Bernhard was the formal head of Bilderberg until 1976, stepping down after being caught red-handed in a bribery scandal. Rettinger, a Pole with a German name, was general secretary and, some believe, the real head of the outfit. Joseph Rettinger has a shadowy career as a political activist, conspirator, and probable spy going back to World War I. He was at one point or another expelled from France, Mexico, and the United States. But Rettinger also became an advisor to presidents, prime ministers, and corporate chiefs. He was always a man who preferred to work behind the scenes. Why? Bilderberg's members and invitees are a select mix of politicians, bureaucrats, bankers, and industrialists with a flavoring of lawyers and academics. A roster of the original 1954 gathering indicates some 60 attendees, mostly Western Europeans, but including 12 Americans. Even most of these were technically guests, not necessarily members. In more recent years, attendance has grown to 100 or even 150. All who attend are magically stripped of their office once they enter the meeting. They're sworn to hold in strict confidence everything discussed there. That raises the question, why all the secrecy? Especially since it's all supposed to be advisory. But is there an elite secret society that demonstrably achieved something tangible, you know, like overthrowing a government or starting a war? Why, yes. And it begins with one rich guy named Cecil Rhodes. He was a Victorian English businessman and an unabashed imperialist. Rhodes also believed he'd been chosen. His devotion to the British Empire was downright fanatical. Rhodes became a Freemason, but he quickly became disillusioned with ordinary Masons. He thought they wasted time on ridiculous and absurd rites without an object and without an end. Rhodes had more important things in mind. In 1877, at the tender age of 24, Rhodes made a will. In it, he dedicated his life and fortune to the establishment, promotion, and development of a secret society, the true aim and object of which shall be the extension of British rule throughout the world. No one could accuse Rhodes of thinking small. He dreamed of extending British rule over Africa and South America, the Pacific Islands, the Holy Land, Malaya, and the seacoasts of China and Japan. He obsessed over the ultimate recovery of the United States of America as an integral part of the British Empire. Rhodes was convinced that Britons were the first race of the world. Rhodes wanted a one-world order under British hegemony. His ambitions literally reached to the stars. He would annex the planets if I could. He believed a world order dominated by Britain would be in the best interests of humanity. So imagine what happened when two small republics in South Africa, the Transvaal and Orange Free State, got in his way. Rhodes made his fortune in diamonds and gold. Along with men such as Alfred Beit, Rhodes formed the giant De Beers Mining Corporation, as well as the British South Africa Company that controlled the Cape Colony. In 1890, Rhodes became the governor of the Cape Colony. The colony bordered the Transvaal and Orange Republics. In 1884, gold, lots of gold, was discovered in Transvaal. Rhodes was determined to secure it for the empire. He'd been busy preparing his secret society. In five successive wills, Rhodes dedicated large sums to the order. He recruited men, including his partner Beit, financier Nathaniel Rothschild, press baron William Steed, and up-and-coming statesman Alfred Milner. In 1891, the order was formally inaugurated as the Society of the Elect. At the top, of course, sat Rhodes. Below him was the Junta of Three, consisting of Steed, Milner, and Viscount Escher, a man with great influence at the royal court. Escher praised Rhodes as a splendid enthusiast of vast ideas, but thought he was quite unscrupulous and treated men like machines. Escher, by the way, was a member of another influential secret society, the Apostles, which I'll mention later. Below the junta, the elect included men carefully recruited from the political and business elites. Many of them, like Milner, would play important roles in the British government for years, even decades to come. Below the elect was an association of helpers. They were less influential but promising members of the establishment. One of these was an officer of Rhodes' South African enterprise, Leander Starr Jameson. Meanwhile, thousands of foreign miners and businessmen had flooded into the Transvaal gold fields. Most were British subjects. The rulers of the Transvaal, the Dutch-speaking Boers, called these interlopers Uitlanders or Outlanders. They were free to work, but the Boer governments denied them political rights. That bred resentment that Rhodes conspirators exploited. In the Transvaal capital of Johannesburg, Cecil's brother, Frank Rhodes, organized a reform committee that secretly prepared an Outlander uprising. Meanwhile, elect member Alfred Beit financed the Reform Committee and a small army of 600 men led by helper Leander Jameson. In December 1895, Jameson's force invaded Transvaal and headed for Johannesburg, where they expected the Reform Committee to have seized control. The British government approved none of this. It was all the work of Rhodes Society. The result was a complete fiasco. The Reform Committee got cold feet, and Jameson's troops surrendered to the Boers. In the fallout, Cecil Rhodes resigned as governor of the Cape Colony. It was a setback, but not a defeat. Rhodes' wealth, influence, and secret society were intact. In 1899, new provocations goaded the Boer republics into declaring war. This time, the full weight of the British Empire descended upon them. By 1902, they were crushed, occupied, and annexed, just as Rhodes desired. He got what he wanted, but he didn't live to savor it. Rhodes died in 1902 at the age of 49. What became of the Society of the Elect? Did it, as some contend, fade away prior to Rhodes' death? Or did it grow into something even more powerful? One arguing the latter was American historian Carol Quigley. In his 1966 book, Tragedy and Hope, Quigley laid out a history of the society post-Rhodes. According to this, Lord Milner ran things until the mid-20s. Others followed right up to the present day. Milner diversified the society by bringing in not just conservatives and liberals, but socialists as well. In a 1903 speech, Milner embraced the creation of an aristocracy of purpose that would become the elite of a new world order. With members in all camps, no matter who ran the government, the elect would be present. An early example was something I mentioned earlier, the Coefficients Club. It lasted from 1902 to 1909. Organized as a dining society where members casually shared views and debated policy, the Coefficients' nominal founders were upper-class socialists Beatrice and Sidney Webb. Milner was a member. So was radical pacifist Bertrand Russell and writer H.G. Wells. Future Foreign Secretary Edward Grey, the man who brought Britain into World War I, was another. When the Coefficients fell apart, Milner created the Round Table Groups. They also used a discussion group model. The Round Tables later spun off think tanks like the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Round Table influence spread to America in 1921 through the Council on Foreign Relations, or CFR. The CFR later begat the Trilateral Commission, and both overlap with the Bilderbergers. The two most important goals for Rhodes were the creation of an imperial federation and bringing the United States back into the fold. The imperial federation became reality as the Commonwealth. While the United States never returned to the bosom of the empire, America and Britain did unite in two world wars and forged a unique, special relationship. There's also cross-pollination between the Round Table and a famous or infamous British university society, the Cambridge Apostles. It was founded in 1820 as another discussion society. Students were carefully chosen for a cross-section of ideological and sexual preferences. Again, the aim wasn't to create a club of the identically minded, but a diverse group united by allegiance to the society. Graduated apostles, dubbed angels, went on to hold important posts in government and business. Cambridge, along with Oxford, were no ordinary universities. They were the finishing schools of the British elite. Another secret organization that figured that out and exploited it was Soviet intelligence. What the apostles are best known for today is their connection to the Cambridge spy ring of the 1930s and 40s. It was a covert program of communist recruitment that penetrated the highest levels of the British establishment and compromised British intelligence for decades. Any mention of collegiate secret societies invokes the American equivalent of the Apostles, Yale University's Skull and Bone Society. It dates back to 1832 and was the extension of an unnamed German order. Skull and Bones was chapter number 322, which suggests that the original order was a large one, or maybe 322 had some esoteric significance known only to initiates. Skull and Bones isn't a fraternity, but a senior society. 15 members of the upcoming senior class are chosen or tapped each year. Again, the emphasis is on diversity as opposed to uniformity. A typical year might include a couple of artists, a prominent jock or two, some eggheads, a notorious radical, and a staunch conservative. The society's influence is thus spread far and wide. An excellent example is the U.S. presidential contest of 2004. Both candidates, George Bush and John Kerry, were bonesmen, and neither wanted to talk about it. Being a bonesman isn't just a college experience. It's lifelong. You join a legion of bonesmen ensconced in places such as Congress and Wall Street. Just like the Bohemian Club, Skull and Bones has its own bucolic retreat, Deer Island. Of course, there are bonesmen among the partiers at Bohemian Grove. As always, the question is, what's really going on? According to scholar Anthony Sutton, Skull and Bones is nothing less than America's secret establishment. Researcher Alexandra Robbins speculates it's an outgrowth of the Bavarian Illuminati. Or is it just another instance of privileged males, and today some females, bonding for fun and mischief? And Skull and Bones is just one of dozens of secret collegiate clubs. So was there an elite society that was, well, diabolical? Why, yes. The place was Weimar Germany, and the society was the so-called Freemasonic Order of the Golden Centurion, or FOGC. Despite the name, it had nothing to do with regular Freemasonry. The name disguised a society dedicated to mastering, in theory and practice, almost all black magical techniques. Brothers were bound by oaths, blood rituals, and mental pacts. Initiates were promised personal advantages, influence, power, and money. The order began in Munich in the 1840s. Its founders came from Germany's first generation of rich industrialists. Like Cecil Rhodes, they'd worked hard to attain wealth and wanted more. And they were willing to sell their souls to get it. FOGC membership was strictly limited to 99. The honorary position of number 100, completing the centurion, was the lodge spirit Barzabel, also referred to as Asmodeus, or King of Demons. Lodge members swore absolute obedience to him, and allegiance reaffirmed every 5 years on June 23rd, St. John's Eve. If no member had recently died, the brothers drew lots. Whoever received the single black ball became the lodge sacrifice and was compelled to drink poison. In return, the demon bestowed his favor on the rest. A new member was added to replace the sacrificed brother. The sudden deaths of two prominent Germans are sometimes attributed to the Golden Centurion, though neither died by poison. One was mega-industrialist Hugo Stinnes, whose empire commanded 4,500 companies. Stinnes expired in 1924, supposedly from complications of surgery. The other was the 1922 assassination of businessman-turned-foreign minister Walter Rathenau. Rathenau's killers were themselves members of a secret society, a right-wing terrorist group called Organisation Consul. Rathenau's death occurred on June 24th, St. John's Day, directly following St. John's Eve. Rathenau is also credited with lifting the veil on what some consider to be the ultimate elite secret society, the Committee of 300. In 1909, the same year as the roundtable groups appeared, Rathenau gave an interview to a Vienna newspaper in which he referred to 300 men, each knowing all the others, who together control the economic destiny of the continent. He was certainly talking about an elite, but that doesn't necessarily translate into a secret society. Rathenau's quote is frequently used to conjure up a vast conspiracy embracing everything from Freemasons, Zionists, Bolsheviks, and Bilderbergers to the Round Table, Rosicrucians, Fabian Socialists, and the Order of St. John of Jerusalem. What became of the Golden Centurion? Supposedly, they were suppressed, along with the rest of Germany's secret orders, after the Nazis took over. That probably meant they just went underground, which could mean they're still around. But there's another theory. Instead of dismantling the Centurion, the Nazi elite took it over. They coveted the favors of Barzabel, who was the spirit of war. Some even see the Nazi Party blood purge of 1934, which commenced on June 30th as a mass sacrifice to the demon. If so, was the later Holocaust an even bigger one? The thing about elite secret societies is that they attract people who already see themselves as special, and they have power. The arguably dangerous thing isn't that such groups rule the world, or that they ever could, but that they think they should. So they unleash violence and chaos, all in the name of some greater good. And getting richer, of course.